Well, let's do a review. Kind of prime the pump a little bit, very briefly. We started off talking about the life of Thomas Aquinas. His years were roughly 1224 or 1226 to 1274. If you remember, it's thought that this unconscious material is possibly his visions on his deathbed. Why should we care? Well, because whether they're his visions or not, they come out of this time period. And they're reflective of the nature of the unconscious as it exists in a compensatory role to the Christianity of its time. In some ways, we're very far from that time. In some ways, we're not very far from that time. The similarities, I think, would be that we still want to live in an ordered universe. We still want life to make sense in a rational way. We still basically believe that good is good and bad is bad. We may talk freedom of the body, but generally we're not. So that is all a legacy of medieval Christendom. And this unconscious material is a reaction to that and an attempt to move that forward so that you could just as well apply the usefulness of these visions to today to the extent we're still living under that worldview. We talked about the book having two parts, chapters 1 through 5, which is a description of the experience of wisdom in this encounter, whether it be a deathbed vision or otherwise. And then we're almost finished with that. We'll finish that up today. And then chapters 6 through 12 are about what the person who had this experience has to go through in order to integrate it, in order to understand it, in order to be able to make changes in their lives, in their life, that these visions are directing. We talked a little bit about Sophia first conceptually, and for that I referred to the book Number in Time. And the basic model in Jungian psychology is that we're here before we were born, where we are, our identity is a priori, prior to experience. And that events in life occur to make that potential realistic. And the first way that Jung understood how that process happens is through the images and dreams. Each image in a dream would be a little piece of yourself, of your real self, or a picture of how you're avoiding your real self. And the idea is that these images are mental. They're psychological. What Jung then observed with these images also occur in physical reality, and that's what we call synchronicity. At some moments, it seems that this a priori identity, now this is all using old world language, but for the sake of it, has the power of actually orchestrating events in reality so that its symbolic message can come through not only through dream images, but through synchronistic events, through apparently coincidental events. We talked about examples of that. That's Sophia. In thought form, Sophia would be a personification of the a priori nature of who you are. She would represent the plan of who you are, and she she is not only a spiritual phenomenon, because we have seen that this this guiding function of the personality can also appear in matter. So she is also a material phenomenon. So she bridges two worlds, and indeed that is how she has been described throughout the history of religious traditions. So she would represent the a priori plan as it can be manifest in the material world. Now, material world, you can take it literally, or you can take it a little more symbolically. It can, and very often is, a physiological experience, an instinctual experience, a love experience, or a hate experience, some very strong emotional experience that involves your physical being in the sense that you are enraged or impassioned. That's another way she can appear. There are others, but that's just, I'm just trying to give you the tip of the iceberg. So the basic idea is that Sophia bridges matter and spirit. Spirit isn't only spiritual with Sophia. Spiritual is also material, or material is also spiritual. Then we talked about dreams, in which Sophia is represented, and a couple of the themes were starlight. The starlight would represent the pattern of your being, because stars form constellations, and since light represents consciousness, those forms of your being aren't only a static entity, they're a dynamic entity. It's as if that form of your being is a knowing that knows you. And you have to get to know the knowing that knows you. That's why Sophia is often represented as a light. She's an active consciousness that is... on the other side of your awareness, but which is nonetheless an awareness, and it is seeking for us to know its point of view, her point of view. Another example we talked about was the image of the board game, because board games are often thought to represent the activity on earth of some higher drama of the divinities. This is in anthropological contexts. Another image was the dual mandala, and that can be as simple as, you know, going from a garden to a circle. See, that's downtown. That could be a dual mandala, from one circle to another circle. And the idea there is that one circle would represent the pattern, the other circle would represent time and space. So when you're dealing with this issue of coming in contact with authentic selfhood, it's often symbolized by these dual mandalas. Another image we talked about was DNA in dreams, because DNA would represent the biological pattern of your life, the source of the biological pattern of your life, and Sophia would represent the source of the psychological pattern of your life. Another dream image we talked about was the idea of being, you have to scrounge for a chair out. Sorry, I think there's some around in the hall, or pull a comfy, whatever. Let me see. Yeah, being known, a child being born who's known before it was born.
Who's what?
Who's known even before it is born. Like the dreamer meets a child and realizes that the dreamer has known that child before. We had a dream like that. Then we talked a little bit about Sophia historically, so that what we're talking about with Sophia really isn't Jung's creation. It's simply Jung taking a phenomenology of an image and applying it psychologically. Sophia is described from the Old Testament forward as the pattern, the secret pattern of God's plan. That's one of her main places of appearance, basically in Proverbs. And then in some apocryphal literature in the Old Testament. I'm just going very quickly. Her other real main stage was in Gnosticism, where, let me backtrack a second. In the Old Testament, she was called Chokhmah, and that is simply the Greek for wisdom. English is the English for wisdom. Wisdom is the English for wisdom. Wisdom. Chokhmah is the Hebrew for wisdom. Sapientia is the Greek for wisdom. Is that right? No. Sapientia is the Latin for wisdom. Sorry. Sapientia is the Latin for wisdom. And Sophia is the Greek for wisdom. So Sophia in Gnosticism, now remember Gnosticism, to be very brief, was the name given to a group of sects, S-E-C-T-S, I always have to spell that, that probably are pre-Christian in origin, but really we begin to take notice of them around the time of Christianity, who held Christian, what they considered Christian beliefs, but in interpretations of that Christian event, which the later church deemed heretical. And it is really probably just a matter of chance what was finally called dogma and what was called heresy. And what these Gnostic sects believe was that at creation, God got trapped in the world. A little piece of God got trapped in the world. So there's a divine spark in everybody and in everything. And sometimes it's a piece of divinity. Sometimes it's a piece of Sophia. Sophia is a partner of God, and at the creation of the world, it isn't God who gets trapped, but God's feminine side, Sophia, who gets trapped. And how that jives with what we've been talking about is that we are looking at the role of matter in communicating spiritual experience. So that Sophia in the Gnostic tradition is in matter. So you've got in the Hebrew understanding that Sophia is the pattern of God's plan, and in the Gnostic tradition that pattern of God's plan, so to speak, Sophia, has been trapped in matter. So we're looking at matter as the vehicle of spirit, not spirit as the vehicle of spirit. And that is a quick summary.
So should the reason we have synchronicity?
Synchronicity would be the manifestation of Sophia in this language, yeah. Let's just look at a couple of the main images in the book. Again, just touching on the absolute top of the heap. I think the first of all, let me just reiterate. When reading a book as difficult as this, and they don't get much more difficult, always ask yourself, what image are we talking about? And it's always helpful, I think. You can get so lost in all the details that you can always bring yourself back and say, what image are we talking about? Well, we've talked about quite a few. I've just picked out 1, 2, 3, 4 main images. And if that's all you remember, be happy. You don't have to worry about all the details. Just try to get a main image in your mind, and then remember what we've said about it. And then I think for our first read-through, you're doing pretty good. The first main image we talked about, which I think sums up Sophia very well, it's on the text on page 157, is that Sophia is likened to the hot wind. Wind is spirit. Now, some of you have heard this so many times, I'm afraid you're gonna puke. 157. But what's Jung's definition of spirit? Oh, yes. Go ahead, Mary. No, you carried it. You can.
That factor which creates images and the inner field of vision and organizes them into a meaningful order. Thanks to Sandy.
Sandy made his bookmarks at the end of. What was it at the end of?
A number of times.
A number of times.
That was
our reward.
As our reward. For sticking it out. See, the idea for Jung is that something in us generates images. And when we've understood an image, the next image that comes along is a step ahead of the last image. This is his basic hypothesis, that the unconscious itself does this. So it's always intending forward. The philosophical word is teleology, goal-oriented, teleological, goal-oriented. So that would be another way of saying God's plan, as it's manifest piece by piece by piece. That's the spirit. Again, for Jung, this is inborn. Not so for Freud. This is where they couldn't agree. Hot wind. And wind is, of course, a symbol of the spirit. It's interesting how often that appears in dreams. There's a wind blowing, and the dreamer wants to float a feather in the wind, and the feather is lost. Or something like that. See, that the wind is the direction of your life. The feather would be the ability to discern the direction of your life.
Can I ask for just a little clarification?
Yeah.
Because this is brought up again with the wind. We're talking about Dionysus a lot when we were considering that particular, except that energy came from below. How does that differ?
Same. Because if it's a hot wind, then this direction-giving capacity is something that comes up from below. And by below, I would mean from emotions and from physiology. This is the big difference between Sophia and Christ, or between Dionysus and Christ. And they're very... Dionysus emphasizes the exaltation more, but they're of the same, they're in the same tribe, these two figures. The idea in traditional Christendom is that the Holy Spirit guides you through the light. In order to get to that, you have to get beyond your desire. Because that only tricks you. And what this is saying is that the spirit, the guiding function, isn't beyond desire. It's in the center of it. That's the big difference. It's not beyond your physiology. It's in the middle of your physiology. I think I may have mentioned, and if this is repeating, sorry, but it might be helpful to hear it. This from below, this the hotness of Sophia, I describe basically in three ways. First, through emotion and desire. Secondly, through disease. I told you the example of the workaholic whose skin cancer was the shape of Florida. So the disease is itself a symbol. The phenomenology, the way the disease manifests, is itself a symbol. We talked about that woman who had the affair and then got a new direction. The guidance came through her lust, not through her transcending her lust and getting revelation, but the revelation came in the middle of the lust. This is the difference. And the other third thing would be synchronicity, where the material world. And heat, because these experiences are emotional. Usually fierily, that's a word, emotional. Either if you're in a serious disease, you're in despair. If you're working with sexuality, you're on erotic fire. And if you're working with hatred, you're in a negative affective state. But that's the fire, and that's the below aspect. Below, in the sense of, if you subject this to a conventional moral interpretation, it is less than good. And the great danger of the worldview of Christendom is that you take these experiences and you say, they're bad, let's go find the Spirit. When in fact, they are the manifestation of the Spirit. I remember when I really first moved here, I had a woman who was seeing, I think, some other sort of therapist and who worked with dreams. And the therapist was on vacation. She fell and broke her leg. And at this time, she was having dreams of angry hoodlums. I said, well, that's probably why you fell and broke your leg. These hoodlums have something to tell you. All she could say is, but they're bad. I know they're bad, but they're trying to tell you something. But if they're bad, what they're trying to tell me is bad. She could never get beyond that moral evaluation. And so the meaning of what happened that fall was completely unavailable to her. The trick in dealing with this material is knowing when to put aside conventional moral judgment. Because there is a morality involved, but it's a much more subtle morality. So below and heat are indications of the emotional and morally ambiguous nature of these experiences, which nevertheless, if a responsible person works with them, are very valuable.
Seems like what it's saying is that it's not dualistic. Which we try to create, it's either good or it's bad, and the bad has to get repressed.
Right.
But this is saying it's all one.
Right.
It comes from one into another.
Right. Yeah, that would be another way to put, well, I think I kind of alluded to it too earlier, that we are erred, and in a way, you know, society can't function without courts and police and law, which is based on right and wrong. But yet, often we are, in our own personal lives, thrown up against situations where you can't say black and white, right and wrong, left and right. It's a both and.
Well, and I would add, look how involved, how close the criminal world, the underworld is with the law enforcement world. I mean,
yeah. They
have a lot of exchanges of values and
exactly.
Personnel.
And sometimes you're wondering which is worse, the cop or the criminal. Mm-hmm. Which is why you can see, from one point of view, we still need the old world. Because until you can distinguish between right and wrong, your attempts to go beyond right and wrong will simply be an excuse for acting out irresponsibly what the shadow is prodding you to do. And there is never any consciousness. And what remains is a person who blames and hurts others and denies it. That's the difference.
That's from the shadow you're saying.
Right. Right. Oh, this brings in the whole question of morality and Sophia. I think you have to remember that this only applies to people who can be moral. If you can't be moral, then this doesn't apply. Does that make sense? Because then you just take what I'm saying as an excuse to propagate your irresponsible behavior. And I would say, you know, just as a rough rule of thumb, I watch. Can that person see how they're hurting other people, and do they care? That's an enormous accomplishment. Many, many people we talk to can't see and don't care. Then this doesn't apply. And do they know the difference between right and wrong? Can they see the harmful effects of their actions? That is an enormous accomplishment. So in a way, this is kind of dangerous material because it can be used to justify, say a fellow, a Don Juan, could just justify this for his lascivious behavior. Yet remember with that woman that we saw, the unconscious let her do it once and then said, whoa, now let's look at it. So that's the gray versus the black and white. And for a lot of people, black and white hasn't even occurred yet. They live in gray all the time. Oh well, they say, so what? I hurt somebody, so what? is their fault. So the inability to take responsibility for your effect on the person's feelings and a presence of blaming would be an indicator that this stuff isn't, person isn't mature enough yet to deal with this. Okay, so the first main image, 157 to 159, was the hot wind. To me, that's the most important. That really sums it up. And what we'll be doing is looking at all the implications of that and then looking at what do you have to go through to understand the spirit in that way.
Sorry, can I just add for a very simple clarification? When you were talking about spirit earlier, what I felt you were describing was the unconscious. Are they seen as one thing?
No, because the unconscious can be creative and it can be destructive.
So it's, when you were talking about the spirit, though, is the one that creates images and organizes them in a meaningful order, that spirit, then you said something about it. Does it emanate from the unconscious? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I guess that would be a way to put it. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I would say it's an aspect of the unconscious. Because the unconscious can also be other things.
I think of the images as coming from the unconscious. But what the spirit does is it brings them forth and creates a meaningful order.
The key is meaningful order. Yeah. So Freud would say that the unconscious creates images, but he wouldn't say meaningfully. That's the big difference.
He also doesn't believe in the collective either.
And he wouldn't acknowledge the collective dimension. Okay, everybody happy so far? The next important image I felt was on page 160, where it's talked about that Sophia is trodden in the mire. And what von Franz makes of that is that is a phrase also used to refer to the beginning material of an alchemical process. That's what the alchemists will say is the case for their material that they start working on. And what that tells us is that this Sophia experience is going to be an experience that has to go through a process of transformation in order to be made real for the visionary, let's say. So we have both a spiritual image, spiritual / material image, and we have an illusion, a preview, that the show to come is going to be alchemical.
What did you say at the very beginning of that? The Sophia experience has to be
transformed, maybe?
Have to go through a process.
Process of transformation. Well, again, if you think about it, that's simply saying now in text language what we've been saying, that these raw experience, these raw emotional experiences in and of themselves don't tell you anything. It's only when you begin working on them, looking at them through the point of view of your dreams, reflecting on them, meditating on them, that you begin to see the meaning that they're intending. And then comes the whole problem of what you have to go through to understand that meaning and then to put that meaning into effect. All of that is saying, in other words, that this Sophia experience initiates an alchemical process of transformation. So that's the second main point. First, the wind. The second is the trodden in the mire alludes to the alchemical transformation to follow. The next main point is on page 164, and that is this whole image of sparks. Stars. No relation to me. Not even why I picked this book. So fiat, one of her key symbols, probably the key symbol, is starlight. We talked about that, right? And again, until you know the story behind the images, if you have a dream, I'm walking on a starlit night. You don't realize that's a reference to Sophia. It's so banal as to be ignorable. Once you realize that Sophia and starlight go together, when you have a starlight dream, you realize, this is a Sophia dream. And then you can see, what is my relationship to that starlight in the dream?
Does it have to be a star, or can it just be a light in darkness?
I think it can be a light in darkness, okay. Yeah. It can be a variety of images of illumination. Yeah, but I think one of the most common, and again ignored because it just seems, well, why wouldn't it be a starlit night if I'm walking at night? You know, because mm-hmm. You take these things for granted until you realize, that is a mythological image. Starlight is a very important mythological image, and I think the key there is the patterning. Well, that's kind of where we left off, and zero in on the last image we stopped with. But that's what I wanted to say as an introductory material. Does that all sound familiar? Clear? Okay. So we left off then on page 2. Actually, we finished 208. But I want to back up and re-examine to get the juices going. The image on page 203. From which the text takes its name. Remember, aurora means dawn. Consurgens means rising. So the book is about the rising dawn.
Rising.
So the text on 203, let's read through it, top of the page. Now the title of the book is Baptize the Rising Dawn, and that for four reasons. Firstly, it is called dawn, as one should say, the golden hour. For so hath this science an hour with a golden end for them that rightly perform the work. Secondly, the dawn is midway between night and day, shining with two full hues, namely red and yellow. So likewise doth this science beget the colors yellow and red, which are midway between white and black. Well, the important point there is just the title, The Rising Dawn. We'll be talking about that more in a minute. You also have allusions, those of you who are interested in symbolism, with all the chemicals, all the colors of alchemy. And the alchemists basically say that their process goes through four colors. It starts out black, and then red, white, and yellow. Now, you find it in all different versions. But the idea would be you start with the blackness, which is the despair, the confusion engendered. The red would be the emotional period you go through as you become conscious of what is underneath that black. And the white would be the clarity that comes to you after you've gone through that. And the yellow would be the gold that comes from having endured the process. That's according to 206. What she says about the aurora is nothing new, but it's hearing in different words this idea that I've been trying to communicate on the nature of the knowledge that Sophia personifies. Second paragraph, psychologically, this aurora symbol denotes a state in which there is a growing awareness of the luminosity of the unconscious. So what's that mean, luminosity of the unconscious?
Brilliant and brilliant too.
Yeah, the knowledge that is in there. It's actually not quite right that I say knowledge. The knowing, or it might even be better to say the knower that is inside there. Which is a kind of a light. And the two main images for that light are starlight and? I'm not that narcissistic. Moonlight. It is not a concentrated light like the sun, but rather a diffused glow on the horizon. That is, on the threshold of consciousness. The anima is this feminine, you know, when we say anima, I think you, for the women, you could transpose the female dimension of the self. Same thing.
Oh, it's a shame that von Franz, being a woman, didn't write this from a feminine perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she didn't write it from a female's perspective.
Well, talking about it in terms of the anima,
sure.
I mean, and, you know, a woman's psychology.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to make the translation.
But of course, she's working with Thomas Aquinas. So.
Yeah.
Poor Thomas.
Well, she's also a product of her era. And,
yeah.
You know, we're very engaged in intellectual.
What are her years? Is she still alive?
No, she died in what? 98?
Oh. She's just a 20th century product.
Yeah.
Which is most like 19th century, unfortunately.
Well, the other women in the group were writing, some of the other ones were writing from that perspective. Tony Wolfe was.
Yeah, I think I'd have to say she's writing it here because it's the text of a man. I never felt she was.
Where are you?
206. I never felt she was biased in that regard.
I just would love to have heard that from her.
It's true, there's precious little in our field, and she did write that one, which Inner City just put out, the Passions of, I think it's Perpetua.
Oh, yeah.
That just came out, which is a woman's visions.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. Kind of depressing because she gets thrown to the lions at the end. So it's not a concentrated light like the sun, but rather a diffused glow on the horizon, on the threshold of consciousness. So that's the key thing, this diffuseness. And what's so weird about this Sophia and the knowledge that Sophia represents is, on the one hand, it is so subtle and so easily ignored. And I think in that regard, the image I always carry around is of the wind. And it's there all the time, but you don't notice it until you have a very light object and you throw it. A heavy object, you see, it won't register. So it's a very subtle presence that it takes a very subtle mind to register it. You know, a Big Mac mind won't do it. You have to have this gentleness of perception to feel the direction of your life or somebody else's life. It is so subtle. And yet, on the other hand, the effects that it orchestrates are massive. It will ruin people's lives. I recently have seen two people die who just simply refused to understand this spirit. It was so subtle, but so, in its consequences, so strong. So the fact that the starlight barely illuminates is a nice image. The fact that the wind is so gentle is a nice image. And the fact that the text is called sunrise, that first diffuse appearance of illumination in the morning is another apt image. It's an incredibly subtle thing on one hand, and on the other hand, it's enormously powerful.
The wind can also be a tornado, though, and very strong.
Sure. Right. And that's an interesting point, because we're going to see what follows here in the first chapter of the alchemical process is a storm.
Right. And I think a lot of people tend to really relate when it's soft and gentle, but when it comes a little more forceful, it's sometimes interesting.
It comes forcefully, and then you're forced. But usually, I think when that's the case, that isn't the message.
No.
That's like, I always think of like the unconscious sort of thinks like D-Day, you know. First, it strafes the beach. And then it sends in the artillery until everyone's good and upset. And then it starts giving you the subtleties. But true, when it's about announcing the gentle wind, often it starts with a very strong wind. That's true, a storm. This anima is the feminine light of the unconscious, bringing illumination, gnosis, or the realization of the self. Who's in the solution? So dawn is this fourth image.
You know, Gary, is there a point when you're working on this sort of stuff, you know, when in consciousness where, for example, when you're dealing with real strong, forceful winds type of thing in your psyche, that you are coming from a meditation point and you can't calm the water? Is there a point where we create or co-create with that? And become kind of the create, I mean, blending it as far as the collective connecting and all of a sudden making the changes that are necessary?
I think it depends on the storm.
Yeah.
If you're dealing with your own personal storm, what calms the beast, so to speak, is when you understand the direction of the spirit. And that is a sort of brooding on oneself, incubating oneself. This storm, I brought a dream along, so I'm kind of, in a way, I'm glad you brought this up. I brought a dream along of a storm, which is not a personal storm, but the storm of history, war. War is often symbolized by a storm. And there it's not so clear how you deal with it.
And I just had it was interesting just even with the hurricane. All my family was right in that area. And it was really interesting. There was a group of us that got together, and it was really more the meditation, sending more love into the earth. It was kind of an interesting, really a profound experience I had with that. But from it dropping from a 4, so getting to a 2, you know, I mean, just in that whole time of, you know, fasting and prayer and meditation and all that, it was really interesting. With the collective, you know, group doing that it impacted me as far as being interested. I just think if all of us did that, you know, the power would really.
Well, I'm going to get to that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hold that thought, because we'll come back to that. Okay, 207. Now we're going to slow down again. And so our dawn, at its greatest redness, is the end of all darkness and the putting to light of night, of that long drawn out winter, wherein he who walketh, if he take not heed, shall stumble. For of this it is indeed written, and Night to night showeth knowledge. Day to day uttereth speech. Now here comes the key phrase. And night shall be light. That's what we focus on. Night shall be light as the day of its pleasures. So the dawn is a light, and at the same time, it's a darkness that is a light. I mean, you have to be, get rid of your linear head. I think, you know, you get the idea that the darkness is the light in the fact that the dawn comes at the end of the night. That's the idea. Now, that is a reference to John 9:10. John 11:9-10. Which reads this way. If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the light, in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. And we have to look at the implications of that. See, that passage is saying light is light and dark is dark. But this passage is saying dark is light. You with me so far? And the light that's missing in the passage in John is, of course, Christ. So I read that again, John? Is that okay?
You're not reading that from the book?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. I just checked the New Testament. John 11:9-10. If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. So the light of Christ, that means, is not in him. The point that she wants us to draw from here is that this is a reference to Christ, this passage, through it being an echo of the verse in John.
Well, it's kind of like a cosmic crisis, how long does it do that too? Because to me, isn't that proceeding going into Revelations, where the deeper the knowledge or the more expansion you get, then the night turns into day and the day into night.
Right.
And then the lamb will sleep with the lion and all that.
But the aurora she wants us to realize is it is implied in this text, mm-hmm. is Christ.
Right. That's all I understood.
Yeah.
I want to ask a very deep and simple question. When you say Christ, are you talking about the man Jesus or the concept?
Well, neither. She is trying to say that this text...
You quoting John, then.
Yeah, she is saying that whoever wrote this passage is alluding to John.
Okay.
And in that allusion, aurora is linked with Christ. Now, Christ here is the Christ believed in by the medieval Christian.
And was that the risen Jesus?
Well, it doesn't matter.
Oh, okay. I can buy that.
She's not trying to make a theological statement.
But there are quite a few of them here.
She is trying to show us how this guy now is trying to bring his experience into relation to the church.
Okay.
That's the point of it.
That's why I need something and go back
and read it. Well, it's not easy to figure out, believe me.
Oh, you have no idea how I studied this. Fuck. Pardon my hair, it's really sweet.
Now, she goes on, looking at this business of the darkness being the light. And she does it on page 208 by quoting a Catholic prayer. I want, it's going to get worse before it gets better, but hopefully we can make sense of this.
It's kind of a metaphor, huh?
It's a double metaphor, I think. Triple metaphor. But this is symbolic thinking, and if you're not used to it, don't hesitate to squawk, and I'll try to walk you through it. See, the links here aren't logical. The links are images. And we're so used to thinking in a logical context, it becomes very confusing when we're asked to have our thoughts move not from A to B, but from image to image. And that's what we're doing. And that's how the dream works.
Okay.
That's why she's doing it this way. So the prayer she quotes,
I had missed that altogether,
is from the Easter evening prayer book in the Roman Catholic Church, in which the prayer reads, "O truly blessed night, which alone didst merit to know the time and the hour wherein Christ rose from the dead." This is, excuse me, that night, whereof it is written, "And the night shall be light as the day." So, see, you got the same idea. That's why these apparently different references are being brought in. "And night shall be my light in my pleasures." This is Easter night, the night of Christ's resurrection. So the chain of symbolic thinking goes from aurora. Let me get some water. Goes from aurora to the passage in the text, which is a a reflection of a biblical passage, the implication of which is Christ is the light. To a passage in the Roman Catholic prayer book, that Christ is the darkness, is the light.
Christ is the darkness.
Is the darkness which is the light.
Okay.
So she's linking this passage with the rebirth mystery.
Exactly.
And she's saying that, but she's giving us another hint and saying this rebirth is not the rebirth through Christ, it's the rebirth of the birth in man.
Well, there are two things going on. This is the subtlety. She's not saying that, but she's saying Thomas,
right, exactly,
is saying
exactly
that this experience that he has had is tantamount to the resurrected Christ. That's what Thomas is saying. Why? To unburden himself from the responsibility of carrying that experience.
Psychologically, that'd be to prevent an inflation?
Psychologically, to prevent an inflation. Which remember, he had earlier in the passages where he was going to go out and tell the whole world. So you see, what we're observing now is the effect of this experience on him. First it puffed him up, and then he tries to, in a way, disown it by saying, this is what the church means by. Well, it is and it isn't, Thomas. If it was, you wouldn't have had the vision. And where it's different is in the nature of that darkness. The difference is, suppose that darkness is your lust for a prostitute. You going to call that the risen Christ? Suppose that darkness is your desire to kill somebody. You going to call that the risen Christ? That's where he both saves himself and cheats himself at this moment in his reaction to the experience.
Because he's saying that it's about the darkness? I'm losing what you
call it. Yeah, because he's saying that, oh, I really had part of him is saying, this is so hot that I have to I have to get some distance from it. And I'll get some distance from it by saying, oh yeah, that's what the Christ means, or that's what the church means by the risen Christ.
But isn't there a point now where we're seeing like the Antichrist and the Christ are the same or different points? Or
Von Braun's point is they are the same. And if you're dealing with Sophia, you have to reckon they are the same. But he excuses himself from that difficulty by saying this is the risen Christ. This is the light Christ.
So it kind of goes back to where God says that he creates both the dark and the light, and the good and the evil. They're all basically the same.
They are the same, but that's not what medieval Christendom could live. And very often what we can't live. That's why the text is still relevant.
Yeah, I've had, there's a lot of people that, in my front that had dreams of considering Hitler, dreaming Hitler in heaven, or having visions that Hitler's in heaven, that type of, which has been really interesting. You know, at least in the judgment of, you know, maybe look at it in the physical, the horrific things, and yet, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They have a purpose. And losing the judgment of that, you know, it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hard thing. I'm not there, but it's, you know, it's something I've been meditating on myself.
Well, that's what we'll be doing now in this text, is seeing, now we've got the experience, and Thomas is going to go through, or whoever is going to go through, a whole pile of different reactions to the experience. We've seen the first inflation. We've seen the second. A kind of excusing himself of the difficulty of the experience by saying, this is what the church means by it. Therefore, I don't really have to deal with it. And it won't end. And again, this is not just Thomas. This is typical for anybody who has a hot experience. We'll be seeing the various vicissitudes they go through before they can make a turn.
I'm just going to ask you that. This is, you're just talking about his experience, mm-hmm. because I would think that...
That's why I think this is worth going through. We're not just talking about him.
Yeah.
We're talking about anybody who gets hold of something that's live. I would say somebody who's been told they have a serious disease, somebody who is in love or lust, somebody who's in hate, somebody whose life direction has been radically challenged by a synchronicity, or maybe even supported by a synchronicity, but they don't really want to go through with it. It's where the fire of the unconscious has crossed you one way or the other. Okay, let's take a break.